Good evening. I'm Bradley Graham, co-owner of Politics and Prose, along with my wife, Lissa, and on behalf of the entire staff, I'd like to welcome you to the store. Happy Friday the 13th. I'm going to hope that this turns out to be a lucky evening for all of us, especially for Tom. It is really wonderful to see all of you turn out on such a blustery, cold Friday evening. As many of you know, we do have author talks virtually every evening here, and I'd just like to take an opportunity to highlight a few that are coming up later this month. John Barry will be here speaking about his biography of Roger Williams, the 17th century theologian. Shalom Auslander, who's a Jewish humorist, will be reflecting wittily, no doubt, on questions of history and life in discussing his first novel, Hope, a Tragedy. And Adam Johnson will be presenting his much acclaimed and very timely new novel, The Orphan Master's Son, which is a thriller and love story set in North Korea. And also at the end of the month, you know, occasionally we have big events at the Six and I Synagogue we jointly sponsor. And at the end of the month, we'll be having Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former national security advisor, who will be appearing there in conversation with his daughter, MSNBC commentator Mika, to discuss his new book, Strategic Vision. And I also just want to emphasize that, you know, you don't have to always come here to shop with us. We are now open essentially 24/7 on the web. And we do offer not only physical books that you can buy through our website, but you can download e-books. A lot of people don't know that. We're trying to get the word out. We've been holding seminars here. We had one last night to help people learn how to download an e-book. If you don't know how to do so, we'll be holding more such seminars. But you don't even have to wait for a seminar. You could arrange for an appointment with someone on our staff and bring in your electronic reader, and we will show you how to download an e-book to it. Anyway, this evening I'm especially pleased to be able to present Tom Lipman and his new book, Saudi Arabia on the Edge, The Uncertain Future of an American Ally. Tom is a former colleague of mine when we were both at the Washington Post. Tom's had a long career at the Post, covering foreign and national security affairs, including a stint as Middle East bureau chief. Since leaving the Post, he's been, among other things, an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and is now an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Actually, though, I just heard that his most favorite gig several times a year is speaking on one of these high-end cruises. So, there, you know, you might run into him someday if you happen to embark on his ship. He's written four other books on the Middle East, plus a book on Madeleine Albright's time as Secretary of State. And in one way or another, Tom has been writing about Saudi Arabia for about 35 years now. Now, I worked with Tom not only as a fellow reporter, but when I was an editor, he was one of the flock I herded. And I just wish all the others had proven as easy as Tom was to work with. It's often, well, it's one of the not often spoken about facts at the Post, but a number of reporters there don't really write quite as well as their published stories would suggest. But Tom was not one of them, and I always looked forward to getting Tom's files. They never required much editing. I could always count on them being very clearly written, informative, and accurate. And Tom personally was always a real gentleman to work with.
Little did he know.
Well, I've never been on a cruise with you. That's true. Now, you'll find the same clarity, the same informative style in Saudi Arabia on the Edge. Tom certainly has tackled a very important subject in this new book. In the book's introduction, Tom writes, of the many countries that are vital to the strategic and economic interest of the United States, Saudi Arabia has been the least understood by the American people. Indeed, the Saudis get stereotyped a lot as a people defined by oil, terrorism, and veiled women. But as Tom shows, the kingdom, which is so critical to American interest and American well-being, has become increasingly dynamic and increasingly complicated. It's no longer, as the title of a 1960 book about Saudi Arabia said, simply a place of kings and camels. Now, of course, there's been no shortage of other books about Saudi Arabia, but many of them have tended to look at the past. What Tom largely does in his book is look forward, examining how Saudi Arabia is trying to evolve and the challenges that it faces. He deals not just with the questions of the survival of the monarchy there, of Saudi Arabia's oil dependency, of U.S.-Saudi ties, but he looks at other dimensions, as frequently examined, including the future of women's rights in Saudi Arabia, of social welfare, and even of Saudi agriculture. If you're looking for a book to help understand not just many basic things about Saudi Arabia, but also its future, this book is the one to read. We'll hear directly from Tom in a minute, but before I hand over the microphone to him, I'd like to remind all of you to turn off your cell phones if you haven't already. Tom plans to speak for about 20 minutes, and then he'll take questions. If you have a question, please step up to one of the two microphones that we have here towards the front, because we do record these events so that we can then put them up on the website. And afterwards, Tom will happily remain to sign any copies of his book that you'd like him to sign. And now please join me in welcoming Tom Lipman.
Thank you very much, Brad. Thank you all for being here. I did indeed work for Brad. As editors go, he wasn't bad, you know? I mean, I never speak from a prepared text except in congressional testimony. But I do have notes because a lot of ground to cover tonight. There are a lot of points I want to make, and so forgive me if I look down instead of out for a good bit of this presentation. If you leave here tonight with one thing that I want you to take away with, it's that Saudi Arabia is now a complicated, evolving society, and every day that goes by, there's a national debate or argument going on in Saudi Arabia about what kind of country it's going to be and wants to be. It is not some religious relic preserved in amber, and it's not a place of hot-eyed vigilantes with scimitars between their teeth looking for infidels to behead, okay? And if you walk the streets of the big cities in Saudi Arabia, other than the clothing, the most common thing, the most amazing impression is its ordinariness, its everydayness. Families, people going to McDonald's and going about their business and getting stuck in traffic and going to work and school. So what I thought I would do is I'm going to toss out a set of things I learned doing this book and previous books, not in any particular order of importance, but just to give you an idea of things that you'll find in the book and that we now know about Saudi Arabia that if you're not a student of this, you couldn't be blamed for not knowing these things, right? Normal people wouldn't know these things, okay? So let's start with this. It's the desert kingdom, right? Saudi Arabia has the third highest per capita consumption of water in the world, behind only the United States and Canada. Okay, next. Saudi Arabia is second only to Sudan in the number of genetically caused birth defects per 1,000 babies, and only by one. The reason? Well, anybody with a lick of sense would say it's intermarriage, right? but you can now get learned, peer-reviewed articles written by Saudi doctors in Saudi medical journals trying to prove that it's not intermarriage, because that's not a socially acceptable conclusion. Okay? So the good news in that story is that 30 years ago, there were no Saudi doctors. Okay? Now there are. And Saudi Arabia is the world capital of conjoined twin separation surgery. Okay? Separated conjoined twins from all the world are flown to Saudi Arabia at government expense for their separation surgery, some of it performed by the Minister of Health personally. Okay? All right. You know, when you go to Saudi Arabia, you get a red notice stamp somewhere and sign it with a death's head on it. That's the penalty for drug trafficking. Okay? Death. In 2008, the UN Office of Drug Control reported the following. This is a quote. Last year in Saudi Arabia, 14 metric tons of amphetamines were seized, mostly in the form known as Captagon. That's a popular stimulant out in that part of the world. That's one quarter of all amphetamines seized in the world. 7 years ago, Saudi Arabia accounted for only 1% of such seizures. Okay? This is the perfect society, or it used to be, crime-free, conducting itself in accordance with God's law. Okay. Saudi Arabia is a net exporter of dairy products. It has the world's largest dairy farm. It's self-sufficient in poultry. And now it's even self-sufficient in potatoes. And if you ever watch the consumption of French fries at the fast food restaurants in Saudi Arabia, you'd know that's quite a feat. Okay. Thousands of Saudi women, have driver's licenses. They got them in other countries. They will be ready. Right? For all its wealth, the kingdom has a critical housing shortage, probably millions of units. The population is growing, but the number of households is growing even faster because the country now is about 85% urban. And so the days of the big family compound of multiple villas housing different generations, those days are gone. People can't afford that anymore. There's no more urban land to do that. People are actually beginning to live in apartment dwellings, in apartment buildings, which is completely contrary to the traditional Saudi way of life. And in fact, I got statistics from the World Bank which show that right now, the number of occupants per household in Saudi Arabia is higher than it is in India. That's how short of housing units they are. Okay? And those villas that the Saudis like to live in, they can't, young families can't afford to live like that anymore. And in fact, that's one reason why more and more women are going to work. The families need the money. Men want working wives. Okay. For as long as you've been hearing about Saudi Arabia, people have been asking what happens when they run out of oil. The Saudis will tell you that's the wrong question. They're not worried about running out of oil. They got plenty of oil. They're worried about running out of customers. They believe that the time is coming when the inevitable price increases caused by the greater cost of finding oil wherever it is, combined with new technology and customer resistance, will undercut their most important commodity export. The reason the Saudis are paying to build refineries in China is to lock in a customer base. Okay, that's why they do that. It's not political. Saudi Arabia is on track to surpass Germany as the world's leading exporter of petrochemical products by the end of this decade. Okay? The fastest growing sector of the economy is tourism. My wife and I even stopped there on a cruise. I can show you the photo of her in her abaya. I could talk more about that if you like. They actually issue tourist visas now. It used to be impossible to get a visa to Saudi Arabia, right? Why you would want to go there, you can talk to me about that afterwards, right? Despite its oil resources, the kingdom has an acute and growing energy shortage because of the surging rate of domestic energy consumption. Okay, blackouts are common in Jeddah and other cities. And this is a really perfect microcosm of the problems the country is dealing with. Saudi Arabia is burning about 2 million barrels of oil a day to generate electricity. Okay, that's oil that's not available for export, and oil that doesn't bring in revenue, and oil that's not left in the ground for a rainy day. Okay? And the demand for electricity is escalating on a geometric curve. Okay? It's not just household consumption. Everybody in Saudi Arabia now has air conditioning and electronic devices just like anybody else in the world, but it's industrial and commercial consumption, which is increasing rapidly. Okay, they could switch to natural gas for power generation, but they don't have enough natural gas to do that and provide the feedstock for the petrochemical plants that are the foundation of their industrial development. So there's a shortage of natural gas. There's natural gas all around them. And as John Svakonakis, Carol, you know him, the economist, a French economist over there, as he said, what are they going to do to get more gas? Invade Qatar? But they don't have enough natural gas. They have huge demands for electricity, even for things that beyond industrialization, namely desalination. Right? All the drinking water, household use water in Saudi Arabia now is desalinated water. Those plants are voracious consumers of electricity. Okay? So the result of all this is where this is driving it. And by the way, you would say, doing a strictly economic analysis, you would say that what they ought to do is raise the price of electricity. It's given away. It's virtually free to household consumers in Saudi Arabia. Your economics 101 teacher would have taught you, well, you deal with that by raising the price. But they can't raise the price because giving away gasoline and electricity and water is basically the fundamental bargain between the rulers and the ruled in Saudi Arabia. The people are disenfranchised, but they're taken care of. You can't just raise the prices because you'd be breaking the only deal that allows you, that legitimizes your power. All right. Solar energy? Sure, but not yet. Multi-billion dollar investments in solar energy, but mostly in R&D, years away from making a significant difference. So where that's leading them? You guessed it, nuclear energy. Okay? Coming soon to a kingdom near you. And what most people don't know is that on his last visit to Riyadh as president, George W. Bush signed a memorandum of understanding with the Saudis in which we promised to help them do this. Now, you would think that the words nuclear and Saudi Arabia in the same sentence would have gotten people really worked up here in Washington. But that was a typical media excursion in which, at that time, the only question anybody asked about that visit was, what are they going to do to bring down gasoline prices? No one asked about this other stuff. Okay, Saudi Arabia will have nuclear power within 10 years. They're already building plants next door in Abu Dhabi. And those reasons we didn't believe that the Iranians gave for wanting nuclear power, they're valid reasons in Saudi Arabia. Okay? So you now also have huge social problems that come with a fast-growing population. There's street crime in Saudi Arabia, which they never had in the past. In other words, it's becoming more like a normal country, okay? Becoming just like, I say, just like a real country. And I would warn people, if you go there for the first time, if you go to Riyadh especially, you will fall victim to what I call the Riyadh is just like Phoenix syndrome. Because it sort of looks like Phoenix, and the weather's the same, you know, and people are stuck in traffic, and there's McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts on every corner. And you go in the supermarket, and except for the clothing, and except for the absence of alcohol, it looks like any Walmart. But that doesn't mean that the country's path to the future is smooth, not at all. The issues are not always the ones you read about in the media. I would say the religious extremism issue, extremism in the sense of violent extremism, is a problem, but it's a manageable problem, and they're managing it. The fact that the type of religion practiced in Saudi Arabia is rigorously anti-intellectual is a bigger problem, right? No one reads Voltaire, okay? You can't buy that in the bookstores in Saudi Arabia. He was an infidel. Why would you want to read him? This is a problem that, as you can imagine, has a profound impact on the education system, which I'll get to in a minute. So the country has strengths as it looks toward the future. It's a big economic power now, and an increasingly diverse one, with a growing private sector. It has it's a member of the WTO and a member of the G20 group of industrial countries. It's managed competently at the finance level. The Saudi Arabian Central Bank is very well respected. It has huge amounts of external reserves and no external debt. It has a good transportation network. It has a competent technocratic class. Everyone's educated now in the sense that everyone goes to school and no illiteracy anymore virtually, certainly not among anyone under 50. If recognizing your problems is the first step in coming to grips with them, they've done that. There's much more wide open discussion in the Saudi media now about issues that affect people. And my favorite example of that is an issue that I didn't hear even mentioned beginning in the mid-70s when I first went there until about 2005. And that's a really terrible social problem in Saudi Arabia of spousal abuse, of wife beating and spousal abuse. And then what happened? A woman named Rania Al-Baz was almost beaten to death by her husband. She was a very well-known woman in Saudi Arabia, a television personality. And she allowed herself to be photographed in her beaten state. And the newspapers ran those photos. And suddenly, this was very much on the sort of social agenda in Saudi Arabia. Other issues. A former minister of social welfare told me that as the countries become urbanized, for the first time, you have dependent elderly people with no one to care for them. They don't have institutions to deal with those people in Saudi Arabia. They're going to have to create them. So these are issues that have nothing to do with regional geopolitics or Iranian aspirations or anything like that. So they have the country is also sort of what I would call socially cohesive, even though it's very diverse. You know, they have high mountains with terraced agriculture and misty peaks down in the southwest and a lot of desert in the middle and different environment up in the north near the Iraqi border. Pretty much everybody shares the same religion, the same language, with the exception of about 10% who are Shia Muslims, a minority over in the eastern province. That's a separate problem, which I can be glad to discuss. But there are profound weaknesses in the Saudi system and structure that they're grappling with, and they don't have solutions for yet. People usually begin this discussion with geriatric leadership. I think it's possible that Saudi Arabia could have four kings in the next 10 years. That does not necessarily or even probably portend domestic instability, but it's something that people talk about. It's on people's minds. They have institutionalized a succession system now, but that the new system has never been tested. And we don't know what will happen when the current king and crown prince pass from the scene. Quality of the education, everybody's educated, but the quality of the education is poor. And they've just begun to recognize that. The most interesting, useful, and devastating information about the product of Saudi education came to me not from anybody in the education establishment, from the Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority, which is a government agency designed to promote foreign investment and economic development. They're the ones who have to deal with the fact that people don't want to invest there because the workforce is not properly educated for the modern marketplace. So they're running their own education programs in the Investment Authority, and they provided me with some what we used to call in Vietnam captured enemy documents that had very revealing numbers about the output of Saudi educational system. Again, to a great extent because of the influence of the religion, okay, which simply makes entire areas of discussion and logical conclusions off limits. You can't go there. Okay. They have plans for everything. Any problem I've mentioned and all the others that are in the book, whether it's water or the job market or education or housing or new airports, whatever it is, health, they have plans for them. You go to the ministry, you go to the relevant ministry and you see the deputy minister and he shows you the plan. He takes it down off the shelf and it's always beautifully prepared and got great graphics. And it was done by Booz Allen, or, you know, somebody like that. Guys came from London or Chicago, and they studied the situation, and they built the Saudis a fortune, and they created this great master plan, and then they left, right? These plans, many of them have been officially adopted. They're supposed to be implemented. But the problem is they're all entirely top-down. Okay? You wouldn't create a little league in your community without a meeting of the parents, the ball players, everybody else, the uniform vendors, whoever, to make sure you knew what you were doing, that you had buy-in. You wouldn't do that, let alone plan the industrial future of one of the world's great economic powers, right? It's no telling whether these plans are implementable. Some of them are quite good, but there's no telling whether they're implementable because you don't know where anybody's going to follow where they're leading or whether they're even capable of following where they're leading. Okay? You have an acute problem of lack of accountability in government. To the extent that I've heard even last spring about political unhappiness or grumbling in Saudi Arabia, it really is not about the nature of the system itself, but more about the lack of accountability. The days when any Bedouin in sandals could go up and talk to the king and get his problem dealt with in the king's majlis, those days are in the past. Theoretically, the majlis system still exists, but this is too big a country now and it's too complicated. Half the problems I'm talking about, the king doesn't even know what I'm talking about, you know? So, and they don't have the civil institutions that give people the channels for dealing with these things the way we do through NGOs. Okay, there are no NGOs because they're basically prohibited, okay, because they're politically dangerous. So, and you have an acute shortage of management skills below the top level in government and in business, a severely bloated government payroll. People don't have channels for the energy that would allow them to address whatever is on their minds. Trade unions, whatever you might think. There are no really active environmental groups. This is breaking down to a certain extent because of the internet. Okay, the internet as a people mover tool is now making itself felt, but there are limits to how far people are willing to go. And to a certain extent, people don't want to get outside the system. The Saudis will put you in jail if they think you're out of line, and you do not want to see the inside of a Saudi jail. And people have a problem in that they often, because there's no criminal code, the rules are not really codified, the rules of behavior and permissibility and assembly, so that sometimes you don't find out where the line is until you've stepped over it, to your regret. But people are cautious. So there's a lot of pent-up things in Saudi Arabia. I mean, and there are people in the room who know this better than I do because they've spent more time there, but people are willing to talk about it. They don't seem to be afraid to talk about it, but they are constrained about what they're prepared to do about it, which is one reason nothing happened last spring. One reason. excuse me. There's a mismatch. You all read about the unemployment problem in Saudi Arabia. It's not really an unemployment problem. The number of unemployed Saudis is not nearly as large as the number of non-Saudis who are employed in the country. Okay, there's a mismatch in the labor market. Young men particularly, the graduates of Saudi universities, men from good family, seem to have a greatly exaggerated idea of their market value and their capabilities. And it's much cheaper and more efficient for a corporation in Saudi Arabia, which after all is in the business of making money, to hire a competent MBA engineer from Pakistan than it is to hire an incompetent MBA engineer from Saudi Arabia and pay him more money. Right? This is an intractable problem. The plans look good. I think they're making some progress, but it's going to require a substantial reform of the education system. And partly what's happening, and this is politically dangerous, is that the Saudis got rich overnight, basically, in one generation. Okay? Now, young Saudis are being asked to go back down the scale of employment and jobs that they take, right? They can't all be supervisors and deputy ministers anymore. Right? So now you see Saudis taking jobs they would never have taken in the past, such as hotel reception clerks. Right? Who wants to stand on his feet all day and be nice to strangers and infidels? Right? Well, that now is a job that allows you to work in an air-conditioned environment with people who bathe regularly. You know, that's not bad. Right? But it requires a change in their state of mind. Okay? And that brings me, of course, to the fact that the biggest failure, socially and economically, and in some ways politically, is the failure to find a constructive place for women in the new economy. More than half the women coming out of Saudi universities now are female. Okay?
They're all female.
I mean, well, I'm sorry, more than half the graduates. Those women are all females, you are correct. More than half the graduates coming out of the university are female. Let me make a note of that. And,
drink your water.
Right, there's not, you think it's water. There's not that much for them to do, even the ones who want to do something. I would say I've discovered in the 3 years I was going over there fairly regularly to work on this book that there's been a collective recognition now that the country can't go on, as rich as it is, educating all these women and not getting anything back in terms of creative energy and productivity. And I interviewed a deputy minister of labor who's in charge of a committee to designate more kinds of jobs that women will be allowed to do. It's still going to be a pretty narrow list. People doing the designating, of course, are all men, naturally. But this door is being forced open not because somebody had a burst of enlightenment, but by economics. Okay, if people need the money. And one of the side benefits, of course, of the increasing education of women is that the population curve is not so steep anymore, the population growth, because women who are going to university don't get married at 15 and start having babies at 16. And more women are becoming educated now. Women face systematic and systemic discrimination at all levels, legally, socially. I interviewed women, quite a few women. There are little portraits of them in the book. It's much easier to do now than it was in the past for an external man to interview Saudi women. The women I interviewed are, by definition, not representative. I mean, in the sense that, you know, university women in Boston are not necessarily representative of American females at large. But they know women, and they talk about women and about women's aspirations. And so this is changing because it has to change and because the resistance is being worn down by time and economics and by a new generation of education. And I'll just give you two examples before I turn this over to start to take questions. The king has announced that women will be permitted to participate in the next round of municipal elections in 2015, not only as voters but as candidates. I don't know what the modalities of that are going to be, but it's at least a very important symbolic step. And then, just last week, there was a really important step, and that is the Ministry of Labor began enforcing a royal decree saying that the employees, the sales clerks in the lingerie shops have to be female. Up to now, they've all been men. These men were all men, madam. The oddest sight in a country that's full of odd sights to me was to go into one of the high-end shopping malls, and they're very high-end, and stand outside the Saudi equivalent of a Victoria's Secret store and see the veiled women, veiled, so you can't see underneath the veil, going in there to buy female undergarments, the same ones you'd see in any Victoria's Secret store, and the sales personnel waiting on them are exclusively men, and mostly South Asian men, because women have never been permitted to work in the retail or commercial marketplace. Okay, there's been a huge fight in Saudi Arabia. I I interviewed the woman who organized a boycott of the shops. Apparently, it's finally happening. Now, of course, if you're going to designate new jobs for women and they're going to go work in the mall, how are they going to get there? Well, funny you should ask. And you can get, I guarantee you that they're going to get there by driving, if not this year, then next year or the year after that, because there's no alternative. Saudi Arabian cities have virtually no public transportation, and everybody drives everywhere, and that's how they're going to get there. Now, you'll notice that there are certain things I haven't mentioned: Israel, regional security, the Iranian bomb. But you know all that, I assume. There are chapters on that. I will just say this. 5 years ago, a gentleman named Tony Cordesman down at CSIS wrote a book about a very, very detailed book, look at Saudi Arabia's security issues. And he concluded that the biggest threats to the security and stability in Saudi Arabia were internal. I think when he wrote that, it was true because of the Al-Qaeda uprising within Saudi Arabia that began in 2003. That uprising failed, okay, for a lot of reasons. That uprising failed. The threat of Al-Qaeda blowing places up is not nearly what it was, and that they've gunned them down, those guys who were doing that, okay? The biggest, in the short term at least, the biggest threats to stability and security in Saudi Arabia now are external. Just look at the map. If you were choosing your neighbors, you would not choose Yemen, Bahrain, Iran, Iraq, or even maybe the New Egypt and Syria. Right, to say nothing of what's across the Red Sea in Somalia and Sudan. Right, you can just see the potential dangers. I think, other than Iran, what worries the Saudis most right now is the possibility of state failure in Yemen, which would produce chaos and perhaps waves of desperate people coming across the border into Saudi Arabia. So on that cheerful note, I'm going to stop and open it to questions. As Brad said, we would be grateful if you would go to the mics, because this is just go to the mics, sir, please. Well, you deserve to have me start with you, ma'am. Oh,
thank you. You talked about education a couple of times. What are Saudi children learning and not learning compared to American children?
Well, okay. They learn the basics. They learn reading and writing and arithmetic, right? But the school year is very short, and a grotesquely disproportionate amount of school time is devoted to religion, right? And the history is colored or shaped or tainted, whatever word you want to use, by religion. It's the history of Islam, history of the Prophet, and they learn a lot less than they used to. They learn a lot about why everybody other than Sunni Muslims of the Saudi school of religious belief is reprehensible. Right? They learn a lot of that. Cleaning up this act is going to take quite a while. Sure.
You mentioned one reason. Excuse me. Great talk. You mentioned one reason why there was no Arab Spring in Riyadh. Can you talk about some others, and then?
I'll give you my quick rundown.
Okay.
Okay. By and large, in my experience, and this goes back a long time, the people of Saudi Arabia accept the legitimacy of the Al Saud rulers. Okay. The Al Saud are not usurpers. They didn't come in from some other country. They didn't take power by a military coup. They weren't installed by the Brits or the CIA. Right. They created the country. It took them 250 years to do it. Right? And they succeeded. And so they have sort of earned their place. Second, they've been very skillful, the Al Saud, at using the teachings of the Quran, which basically say that it's the duty of the believer to pay allegiance to the ruler. Okay? Third, to the extent that people have succeeded in Saudi Arabia, they have succeeded because of the system and not in spite of it. So when you read, I've read quite a few of the petitions that have circulated by people criticizing this, that, or the other aspect of the Saudi government. And by and large, to put it quickly, what they want is a reform of the system to give them a greater sense of participation and a greater accountability, which is not the same thing as replacing the system. There seems to be no constituency for that. Finally, I would say one other thing, my own personal theory about this is that the people of Saudi Arabia just went through a 3-year period of shootouts in the streets in the Al-Qaeda uprising, right? They don't want shootouts in the streets. They're not prone to violence in that way. They're too busy taking the kids to school. So those are the reasons that I give. There are others. The king handed out a lot of money. The king handed out bundles of money, right? Okay, we give it to the ethanol producers. They gave it to people in the form of unemployment benefits, you know? At least they have the money they give away.
With the growing relationship with the other nations of the world, how have they been successful in not allowing any religious expression other than Islam?
That hasn't been a particularly difficult mission for them. First of all Saudi citizens are and must be Muslims. Okay? And no form of religion other than Islam can be practiced, and no religious building or institution can be built. They don't permit it. Now, foreigners, like let's say there's a huge Filipino population in Saudi Arabia, those people are not mostly Muslims. A private religious observances conducted in people's homes or in the basements of small institutions, of medical institutions and so on, those have usually been tolerated, mostly for foreigners, but otherwise not. Sir?
That was a very excellent talk that you've just given.
Thank you, sir.
Succeeded in being not only informative, but also interesting. This is a very...
They're not mutually exclusive, really.
No. This is a question, actually a minute question. Yesterday, the king announced that he had replaced the head of the morality police with another guy. I don't know who either one of these two are. Are you familiar with who these two fellows are, and does this represent another small...
I missed this latest one. I was doing one of these yesterday. I missed that news.
I'm hoping that it's a small incremental step towards the reforms that he proclaims to want.
Here's what happened. The institution the gentleman is referring to is a group of people usually referred to in the media as the religious police. They're not really religious police. They're the behavior police, okay? And they're sometimes referred to as vigilantes. They're not vigilantes. They're employees of the government. And they're easy to spot on the streets in the cities because of their distinctive appearance. They all have untrimmed beards because of the belief that the Prophet never trimmed his beard. That's the same reason the Taliban didn't permit barbershops. Okay? They don't wear the akal, that black band around the chutra. And they wear their thobes or gowns at or above the ankle instead of all the way down to the shoe top, because they believe that's the way the Prophet wore his garments. So you can spot these guys when you see them. And their job is to enforce the rules. And these rules, most of which don't have specific justification in the Quran or in the Hadith, the teachings of the sayings of the Prophet, but they've become religious rules through custom and tradition and time. So the rules that say that unmarried men and women can't mingle, that the workplaces have to be gender segregated, the rules that say that young men, by which they mean boys under the age of 16 or so, are not even allowed into the high-end shopping malls, so they don't go in there and ogle the young ladies. These guys enforce those rules, plus the prohibitions on alcohol. Right? In Abdullah's time as king, this force has sort of been collectively toned down. They're no longer allowed to make arrests. They have to have actual real policemen to make arrests. And they've all been retrained. They went through an extensive retraining program at a place out near the Riyadh airport. And they, in many cases, they've sort of opened up the space around individuals a little bit. I mean, I talked to a prominent Saudi businessman who said he's no longer afraid to take his wife to their favorite Italian restaurant. He's not afraid that these guys, the Mutaween, are going to accost them and demand proof that they're married, you know, and be very nasty about it. So the change at the top of this force has been part of that process. The problem, of course, is this is one reason why Abdullah is personally popular. But these changes are not institutionalized in the sense that they're guaranteed to remain that way under the next king or the king after that. The next king could tighten up for whatever reason. And some people were quite taken aback in the huge package of economic goodies that the king handed out last February and March was a big surge in increase in funding for this force and money to allow them to set up provincial headquarters and so on. So the force is expanding. Whether its power and its activity will be directed in the same way under Abdullah, probably not. But Abdullah is quite an elderly gentleman now. Sir.
Ali Liami from the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia here in Washington, D.C. Tom, I think you presented very good figures about Saudi Arabia tonight, which I didn't disagree with. Facts are facts. My problem with the presentations like yours is blaming the victims for the crime of the criminal. You mentioned the fact that Saudis don't want to work, or close to that. The Saudis...
I don't believe I said that.
No, you alluded to it. The Saudis want, everybody want to be a boss. And they can go and hire people from Southeast Asia for nothing and beat them, actually mistreat them. You never mentioned the mistreatment of the expatriates, the 10 million of them. Saudi people want to work. The people who don't want the Saudi people to work is the Saudi government. Because if you have a very strong workforce, financially independent, they become more active in other issues. So why not keep them down, hand out, you are right, the king is giving money to the right and to the left. Not because he's a nice guy, because he's not. It's because he's buying these people and shut them up. But that's also outliving its importance.
Okay, I take your point.
Women are going to drive, and women are being hired because women are forcing themselves to the government. Reem Asad, you didn't mention her name.
Yes, I did.
You said you interview her. Yep. Her name is Reem Asad, whom I know very well. I know other women. Saudi women are changing the environment in Saudi Arabia, and it is in the best interest of the United States and everybody in this room to support Saudi women because they are the most vocal against religious extremism. Support them. That's an important thing you do. One more point, then I'll ask my question. I think the people here should know the truth about things. King Abdullah is no reformer, Tom. In March of last year, he issued decrees that nobody can criticize any royal family or the religious establishment.
I go to great lengths in the book to make the point.
I didn't read the book, and I'm not going to read it because I know better not to.
I want to respond.
My question is this to you now. Recently, the most two anti-Americans, anti-democracy, religious extremists were promoted to rule Saudi Arabia, a Prince Nayef and a Prince Salman. I would like for you to tell us what kind of future for Saudi Arabia and the international community because of religious extremism under the rulership of these two men?
Make no mistake. Saudi Arabia is a kingdom run by a small group of people in one family who essentially negotiate only with each other. Okay? They can do this because they own the country. when you read about reforms in Saudi Arabia or the establishment of institutions like the National Dialogues or whatever, these are essentially palliatives designed to enhance rather than diminish the power of the al-Saud over the country. I don't mean to minimize that point. In fact, I make it at great length in the book. The country is run under the terms of a basic law of government, which was handed down by King Fahd in, I think, 1992, which makes very clear what the relationship of the rulers and the ruled is. They rule and you shut up, okay? And this is not open to question. And so, and I don't want anybody to think that I'm overlooking the political reality of Saudi Arabia. One reason that the government encourages really intense, furious, endless debates in public and the media about minutiae of the religion is that it substitutes for discussions about real politics. Okay? Absolutely true. I don't believe it's true that the government doesn't want people to work because they're afraid of people, employed people will be more dangerous than unemployed people. I think that's the opposite of the truth. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Mansour Al-Hajj, born and raised in Saudi Arabia. My grandma immigrated.
Ahlan wa sahlan.
Hala. My grandma moved there 40-something years ago. My mom was a little kid when she was there. And I was denied schooling because my dad is not a Saudi. And the comment I wanted to make is, you talked about the Hanin Revolution, the revolution in Saudi Arabia, and you said that Saudi people are not challenging the Al Saud ruling. My question in that regard is, what do you make of the heavy military presence on that day, on March the 1st? And my second question will be about the 30,000 human rights activists who are in jail right now.
What the gentleman is referring to is the so-called Day of Rage. At the height of the events in the Arab world last spring, a call went out for a Day of Rage in Saudi Arabia, which was theoretically designed to produce the kind of mass demonstrations that you'd had in Cairo. And it turned out to be a day of mild inconvenience. And one reason for that, as the gentleman said, was that the government, the security forces, made clear in advance that they were not going to tolerate any demonstrations and you would demonstrate at your peril. I think there's no question. And they backed it up, right? They were in the streets before the demonstrators could get to the streets, and they made sure that nothing happened. That's one reason. But I didn't get the sense that there were wretched masses who wanted to burst out and demonstrate and were intimidated from doing so. And it's also true, as the gentleman says, that there are, I don't know how many. He used the number 50,000. I read all the stuff that comes out of Human Rights Watch and the other organizations about this. There are, of course, there are political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. That is to say, some of them are people who try to do political things. There are harsh consequences for that in Saudi Arabia. You are not permitted to organize, to criticize the king or the royal family in public, to deviate in any way from the official religious teachings. People are put in jail for those things. And the legal system, by our standards, is a travesty. I mean, the justice is arbitrary and cruel, and this is well documented. Now, theoretically, there is in development a full-scale, top-to-bottom reform of the court system. I'd say that to make a pun, the jury is out on that, because I don't see any sign that the kind of abuses that prompt this. I mean, this is not. You know one way to think about this? In a certain way, it's like the Chinese model, okay? You can do a lot of things. You're free to make money, live where you want, travel, right? Marry who your family arranges for you to marry or not, right? You're free to do a lot of things. Start a company, right? You're free to decide whether to make the pilgrimage or not, right? What you're not free to do is to challenge the system, pretty much like China. I'm not promoting it. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. Yes, ma'am.
I visited Saudi Arabia in a couple of times in the 70s. It's fascinating to hear your update on a lot of matters. But some of the things that I particularly remember noticing and wondering about, I wonder if you have a more detailed update. One is the houses, beautiful houses, times four, because there were four wives. Is that still very common to have four wives?
No, people can't afford it.
Well, but the very wealthy can do it. And do
yes,
it
it's work. Legal.
Yeah.
But it's not done nearly as much as it used
isn't,
to be.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, people can't afford it, and it's just not, it's not fashionable.
Yeah. Another was, you touched on this, seeing sort of teenage boys frantically trying to memorize the Quran, and it just seemed, maybe it was the time of year or something, but they were just all over the place struggling with it, with outside and whatever. And I wondered, one got the feeling from conversations that they weren't learning much more but that in their schools.
Quran memorization is, in effect, an honorable profession in that society. And one of the great ironies of the government's attempts or supposed attempts to Saudiize the workforce was that they even had to import foreigners as Quran memorization teachers because there weren't enough Saudis to do that. The problem is that if you memorize the Quran and set out to be a Quran memorization reciter, let's say, or teacher, that's all you're going to be able to do. You know, it's not as if you could decide to forget that and buy a bookstore, you know. But that's not a whole lot of people.
Uh-huh.
Right? People are deeply immersed, steeped in the Quran. It's a profoundly religious society.
Well, just whether they get much else is the question, really.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But why would you need anything else?
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's all revealed in there.
Right. Right.
Sure. Last question, sorry.
Can you give us an idea on media or mass media, sort of like what their TV is exposed to? I mean, you know, we get a pabulum of The Biggest Loser, and give us an up-to-date
this
idea
actually,
of what right. what they're like.
This is actually a very interesting story. There's a quite lively newspaper press in Saudi Arabia, in Arabic and in English. And what you see in the newspapers is extensive discussions of all the things we've talked about, except corruption and royal family politics. Right? The newspapers, just like anybody else in that society, don't challenge the legitimacy of the royal family, criticize individual princes, or challenge the tenets of the faith. They may occasionally challenge individual leaders of the religious establishment, right? A very prominent editor named Jamal Khashoggi did that. It cost him his job. But there's all the television now is a different thing. Everybody got satellite TV now. And they watch Turkish soap operas, and they watch Al Jazeera. Okay, so the penetration of television and the internet has really changed the communications environment. It's not entirely a free for all, no pornography, but it's the television environment is fairly wide open. There's not much market, as far as I know, for pornography, let's say, you know, or for radical leftist oratory, right? But people do have access to satellite television programs and satellite news and so on. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting the high sign over here. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.